BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden. Round one tries to test their vocabularies. Two marks if they get the meanings of these words reasonably right. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Anne, I want to know the meaning of crinkum, crankum.
Crinkle?
Yes, that sort of thing.
Crank and cranky.
What you get in your...
Wiggly-woggly.
Wiggly-woggly will do. Two marks. Full of twists and turns, tortuous, and it can be either literally, like some roads, or it can be figuratively about a character or anything of that sort. Well done, Anne. Two marks. Frank Muir, what is a barton? B-A-R-T-O-N.
A barton? It's a round thing with four holes in it which keep your trousers up.
Better try again, Frank.
Barton. No idea.
It is, in fact, a farmyard, or a farm not let with the rest of the manor, but retained by the owner rather than given out to a tenant. It means a barley enclosure, originally. Dennis Powell, the meaning of the word gravid, G-R-A-V-I-D, gravid.
Heavy?
Yes, in a particular sense.
Heavy plus one.
Yes, heavy plus one, but explain.
Great. Pregnant.
Pregnant, that's better. Two marks it is. Pregnant, in the medical sense, it can be also in a sort of literary sense, pregnant with meaning. Now, Dennis Norden. Dennis, what is a dendrologist? D-E-N-D-R-O-L-O-G-I-S-T, dendrologist.
Well, ology is the study of...
Yes.
Dendro... is
trees.
What's left of a rhododendron if you take rhoda out.
Yes, you're there.
Well, it's not much of a rhododendron. It's not sort of half, is it? Tree. I see. I've just been handed a written note. I will read it to you. Trees. Was that a request for a song? Or is it?
Yes, that'll do. It means a student of or a writer about trees. Quite a subject, I suppose, really. That's the end of that round. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And then I want the two women members of the team to go on studying those quotations, because at the end I shall ask them the source of the quotations. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, here's your quotation. Do not go gentle into that good night. And now, Dillis Powell and Frank, yours is the fleas that tease in the high Pyrenees. And then at the end of the fragment, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these words came to be said or written. Well, the next round's all about verse and poetry. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it with the next line or two. Two marks if they can complete the quotation, and two more if they can correctly name the source. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Wealth I seek not, hope nor love, nor a friend to know me.
Oh, that's one of those wandering poets, isn't
yes,
it?
Yeah.
Stevenson, is it?
Yes, well done.
That's something below me.
That's it.
Oh, yes, so the star something above and the...
What would he have below?
Earth below me.
Or a...
I think
foam rubber cushion or something.
Stars above and...
He was always walking.
And the road below me.
Very good. Yeah. I'll give you your four marks. It helped you a bit, but still. Wealth I seek, not hope nor love, nor a friend to know me. All I seek, the heaven above and the road below me. It's The Vagabond by Robert Louis Stevenson from his Songs of Travel. Frank Muir. Her aunt, who from her earliest youth had kept a strict regard for truth.
Oh, this... At a guess, it smells like Cautionary Tales.
Yes, quite right.
By Hilaire Belloc.
Yes, good. Can you complete it? Yes, absolutely right. And remember the girl's name?
It's Matilda.
Yes,
got it.
Is it?
Yes, absolutely right. Matilda it is. I don't think I'm going to be able to complete it. I'll give you three out of four. It's Hilaire Belloc's cautionary tales, a tale about this terrible child called Matilda, who told such dreadful lies it made one gasp and stretch one's eyes. Her aunt, who from her earliest youth had kept a strict regard for truth, attempted to believe Matilda. The effort very nearly killed her. Now, dearest Bob, if you were the only girl in the world and I were the only boy...
Well, we would find such... something rather
nothing
things to do.
Nothing else would...
Yes?
Come on, Craig.
Papa in the world today. We would go on loving in the same old way.
Sounds like the cup
a fine. Garden of Eden and just made for two. With no one to share.
That's right.
Were the only girl in the world.
You're just
and I
charming,
was
Frank.
The only boy. Sung by Violet Lorraine and George Robey during the First World War in a show called The Bing Boys.
That's right. I think you can get your four marks song. And be able to complete the rap. I'm not going to read it again because you've got it quite right. But it's If You Were the Only Girl in the World from The Bing Boys, written by George Grossmith the Younger and Fred Thompson. Four marks. Dennis Norton. He crams with cans of poisoned meat the subjects of the king.
That's Chesterton.
Quite right.
The grocer.
Yeah.
And it's something about when they found with cans of poisoned meat the subject of the king. I thought, when there's something can drop down dead, he laughs like anything.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Very near right. I'll give you all four marks. He crams with cans of poisoned meat the subjects of the king, and when they die by thousands, why, he laughs like anything. It's a terrible song against grocers, which begins, God made the wicked grocer for a mystery and a sign, that men might shun the awful shop and go to inns and dine. And G.K. Chesterton wrote it. Four marks. Next round's about the origins and derivations of fairly familiar phrases. Three marks, possible total. I want, first of all, the present meaning and then the origin of these words or expressions. Beginning with Anne Scott James. A land of milk and honey.
Well, it means a land where there's plenty of food.
Yeah.
And comfort and money and affluent society, it means, really.
Affluent society, good enough.
And well, I imagine it comes from the Bible, doesn't it? Isn't it where Moses arrived?
Yes.
Exodus.
Yes. A land or a place abounding in good things, and it's Exodus chapter 3, verse 8, in case you want it. God appears to Moses and tells him he's come down to deliver the children of Israel out of the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them to a good land and a large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Frank Muir, a Roland for an Oliver.
It means a half dozen of one for six of the other.
Yes.
A Tweedledum for a Tweedledee.
Yes.
They were romantic characters, weren't they? From the old romances.
Charlemagne.
Yeah.
It's the story of Charlemagne and Roland,
Roncival. And Oliver.
Roncival, yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Roland for an Oliver means tit for tat. And they were two very famous knights. They were paladins of Charlemagne. And they were so equally matched that, as Franca said, anything one could do, the other could do just as well or even better. Three marks. Dennis Power, thumbs up.
Thumbs up means it's absolutely okay.
Yeah.
And it comes from the gladiatorial games.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's wrong, because at least somebody once wrote to correct me anyhow. I always understood that when the gladiator was more or less done for,
mm-hmm.
that the emperor turned his thumbs down if he was to be killed.
Yeah.
Well, somebody wrote to me angrily and said, nonsense, it was the other way around, but I really don't know.
Anyhow,
that's what it's all about.
As far as I know, scholars may disagree on this, but as far as I know, the first is the right interpretation. Well, it means... today, thumbs up means all is well, somebody has succeeded in something or other. And the Romans did, I think, signify approval or disapproval by putting thumbs up or down, respectively. And particularly, as Dillis has said, when at the end of the fight, one gladiator had another one at his mercy,
the chap who was winning looked up at the box where the master of the ceremonies, who might be the emperor, was sitting and said, well, should I finish this chap off or not? Thumbs up meant no, let the chap go. Thumbs down meant, ooh, bang, and he went.
All the other way round. Just to stop any letters.
Getting mixed Greek and Latin in this. Three marks. Dennis Norden, to the nth degree.
Well, it means... means... I'm not sure whether it means to an infinite amount or to a very large amount.
I stick to the first one.
I believe... No, I say this because I believe actually mathematically to the nth degree doesn't mean to infinity. It
no,
means
it
to any...
No,
something to the power of n means to any required number you may choose. You know, they usually say let n be the number. So it didn't mean infinity, it meant whatever you wanted it.
That's right. You are absolutely dead right. The mathematical conception, which is the origin, n equals any number, thus n-dimensional means having an indefinite number of dimensions, and from that it comes to mean to an unlimited extent. But originally, Dennis is absolutely right, this is the way in which the mathematicians used it. Three marks. Next round's about place names, and there are some place names that bring before us the idea of certain commodities which are associated with those places, so much so that the place name is sometimes used on its own without giving the name of the commodity, but everybody knows what's meant. Now, for two marks, with what do you associate the following places? Anne Scott-James, Limoges.
Oh, enamel.
And enamel in a particular sense.
Painted enamel.
Yes, but what would you put it on today? I mean, on what's the ground, the base?
On porcelain.
Yes, thank you. You see, enamel can mean on metal.
Ah, yes, well.
Limoges now porcelain. Is delicate porcelain. Limoges is a city in west-central France. Principally now porcelain, but they did also do decorative enamel work on metal
exactly.
In earlier times. Two marks. Frank Muir, Edam or Adam, E-D-A-M.
It's a Dutch cheese, rather like a bloodshot melon.
But descriptively, Frank is right, a round Dutch cheese, usually yellow inside and with the rind dyed red. I mean, it isn't the natural colour, but they dye it that colour. And it comes from a place in Holland. Dennis Powell, Bakewell.
Tots.
Also the home of Jack Long. And family.
Yes, I'd like any advance on tart?
Well, it's a kind of round cake with a pastry outside and a kind of almond and egg and something or other in the middle. It's very good.
You'd be drummed out of Bakewell if you called it a tart.
Should I?
Yeah.
What should I call it?
A pudding. A Bakewell pudding, in order not to get into frightful trouble at home, or Bakewell tart, as they say it. Dennis Norden, Delft, D-E-L-F-T.
Well, it's a kind of pottery.
Yes, colours?
Blue and white.
That's
blue and white.
Delft, in Holland, they make this particular kind of pottery. Normally has a white background glaze, and the designs or decorations are in blue on this white ground, and it's well known throughout the world. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on the programme. So, Anne Scott-James, for two marks, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Do not go gentle into that good night.
Dylan Thomas.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good enough. It's the title and first line of a Dylan Thomas poem. Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. He wrote it when his father was old and ill. Two marks. Now, Dennis Powell, the origin of your quotation, which was the fleas, the teas in the high Pyrenees.
Hilaire Belloc.
Yes, remember the name of the poem?
Tarantella.
Good.
Yes.
Do you remember an in Miranda? Do you remember an in?
That's it. Two marks. And now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back first to Dennis Norden. Do not go gentle into that good night.
If, when you're broadcasting, you mention a doctor, dentist, or lawyer by name, you can do him an infinite amount of harm. I want you to listen to this name, Milton Mowbray. He's my dentist. I'll repeat it, Milton Mowbray. And I hate him. If any of you who are listening happen to live next door to the British Dental Association, bang on the wall and tell them I'm saying Milton Mowbray. A little fat fellow, he's actually. Used to be a riveter, but he got scared of heights. I went to him last July for my normal 6 months checkup, and was sitting in the chair, and he was doing the usual sort of peering down my gullet, and I was doing the usual ho-ha, ho-ha. You know, that's what you say when the dentist says, you've got your mouth wide open, and he says, am I hurting you? And you say, ho-ha, ho-ha. And he went to look closer, and he took that thing that they use, which is like a long silver stem with a little round mirror at the bottom. And he put that in my mouth, and he put that other thing, which takes all the spit out and goes glug, you know, that sort of glucking noise that it makes. And he looked down into it, and he said, oh, dear. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, I thought he'd backed into the high-speed drill, because he'd done that before, you know. And I said, and he said, you have a cavity, a big, black, round cavity. I said, where? Or rather, yeah. And he said, your left upper canine. Well, I checked it up, because you know that sort of map of your mouth that they keep in the box file? Well, he always sort of lays that on my lap, and I looked at it, where the upper left canine was, and it's sort of like full throw along in the dress circle. You know what I mean? And he said, oh, dear. He said, let's look at the next one. He shifted along, and he said, oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. He said, you've got a cavity in that one, a big, round, black cavity. Well, I didn't believe him. And he shifted along to the next one. He said, you've got a cavity in that. He looked at every tooth and found I had a cavity in every single tooth. Well, you know, I just couldn't believe it. I told him, I don't believe it. And he said, well, come up here and look for yourself, you know. So, you know, it shows the brain power of the man. I said, I can't have. He said, we'll have to have them all out. Which he did. I had them out, and of course I didn't see him again after that, because I didn't have to, you see, anymore. I never will. I got a letter from him last week, and he said, dear Mr. Norden, he said, something amusing cropped up. He said, would you, like being in the business of amusing, might be interested, sort of. He's an illiterate oaf as well, you see. He said, you may remember I took all your teeth out. He said, because of all them cavities. He said, well, I found something rather funny. He said, they wasn't cavities. It was a black speck on my mirror. I'll repeat his name again. Milton Mowbray. Any of you who are listening who may be in any kind of need of attention to your jaws, I beg of you, do not go dentally to that great nit.
I was going on Saturday to my own very nice dentist, and now I certainly shan't. And so we'll go back
to mine now.
We'll go back to the second quotation to Frank Muir. The fleas, the teas in the high Pyrenees.
Did I ever tell you when I was a pink slaver, which is like a white slaver, but I was rather sunburned because it happened in the south of France. It's about 5 years ago. It all came about really because the children were much younger then. We had the two children and the three dogs. And my wife was a bit chocker. She thought she was vegetating, and she just spent all her days shoving chocolate biscuits into expectant mouths and grade A milk, and then the children had to be fed as well. And she thought she wasn't doing anything useful, that she should get some kind of job. Now, this I found absolutely riveting, because I looked through the jobs vacant pages of the newspapers and found that boiler riveters were earning about £28, that steeplejack's mates were earning about £30. So I did my best to encourage my wife, you see, in this very worthwhile endeavour. And she said, well, I can't leave the children and the dogs. We'll have to get some help. And I thought, well, my goodness, at 28 quid a week coming in, you know, we can surely afford this. So I got into an agency which supplies these foreign girls and paid the fee. And after three months, and I paid another fee. And after 3 months, I paid another fee. And we got our first foreign help. She was a rather stocky German woman called Gerda. It's a pretty apt sort of name to have. And she had a nice smile. She came with two cardboard suitcases. We opened the front door, and she said, Guten Morgen! And walked through the front door, through the hall, out of the back door, and we never saw her again. It was really rather odd, because she would have had to climb a fence. Anyway, she disappeared. So we paid another fee. Another 3 months went by, and I was getting frantic. Still no job for my wife, because of this no help. And then we happened to spend these few days in the south of France, on our boat. This was the time when we had our canal cruiser. What happened was we came out of the Regent's Park Canal a bit fastish, and we didn't realise that the tide was going out in the Thames, and that at Ramsgate I turned left instead of right. Anyway, we arrived at Nice Harbour, and we were tied up there, and I got all pink from the sunburn, and we used to have lunch at a little restaurant, and after 2 days we were immensely taken with the hired help. Such a dynamo of energy. You should see her fillet a fish. Whoosh, whoosh, finished, you know. No wonder they say poor soul. And the all that she never stopped for one moment. Do this, polish, clink, clink, clink. Table was laid. We thought, now, if only we could get her. And apparently she would love to come over because we offered her 5 shillings a week because she doesn't know English currency. And she would love to go, but she said that they worked her very hard there and they couldn't possibly let her go. If there was some way that she could escape from the hotel without being seen. So I laid this plan, this pink slavery of abducting this girl. And from the boat, I got a huge zip bag, which we use for bringing on all the blankets and things, a huge sort of canvas valise thing which holds anything. And I carried that into the hotel. Then, at night, when we'd finished dinner, I said to her, you are coming to England with us. And I touched her lightly on the arm, and she went, oh, very jolly girl. Did I mention this? You only had to nudge her, and she went off into fits of, hee, I live only. Just like that, any fatter. And I said, no, get in the bag and don't giggle. So she got in the bag, and I just managed to zip her up. And my wife and I, between us, crept out of the hotel, it was by now dark, onto the quay, of that harbour quay thing at Nice, and got into this tiny little dinghy to row out to our boat. Now, unfortunately, it's a very small dinghy, and a little bit of rocking happened, and I'm afraid that the bag with the baggage inside tumbled into the water. Well, naturally, there's no danger. I mean, she was so fat, she just floated there like a cork and bobbed up and down. So, muffling my oars with my socks so as nobody should hear, I rowed, sculled madly around and poked at this bag to try and bring it nearer. But, of course, this was fatal, because as soon as the oar touched it, there was, gee, came out of the bag, and I was saying, taisez-vous, and be quiet, toi. and other French expressions. But it's no good. There were the police, searchlights. People were crossing themselves, hiding the children's eyes, seeing this curious sniggering noise from the bag. So immediately I rowed quietly out of the searchlight, back to the boat, and left her there. And so we never did get our hired help. We're still poor. But it's so interesting that the last view we had of the spotlight of the police and the fire brigade on this bag bobbing up and down the water, sniggering in the harbour, one would think that this would just be forgotten. But no, it's obviously passed into Mediterranean myth. Because here, in Hilaire Belloc's poem, is a line which, with a poet's facility for words, exactly captures the scene. Remember the line? It's from the poem Tarantella, and it goes, "The valise that he heaves in the harbour at Nice."
It's interesting to remember that the penalty for kidnapping in France is the guillotine. And by your vote, Frank Muir wins the contest of the stories, but the final score for the whole contest is nevertheless that Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden win by 3 marks from de Lispau and from Frank, and that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Schreien and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.